not quite going to complete our study of 2 Samuel tonight, but we will next week. And then after that, we'll go on into 1 Kings. Now, I imagine when we started, you didn't expect we'd spend almost 11 months in this book. Besides the awesome spiritual truths that are contained here and in the books of Kings that we're going to start a couple weeks, there are tremendous practical lessons and much salient biblical history that allows us to better comprehend the words of the prophets and the reasons for the timing of their oracles. And these studies prepare us to understand the New Testament in the light it was truly meant to be understood. Now, I've said it on numerous occasions. The Old Testament is the indispensable foundation of the New. You cannot reasonably hope to understand the New Testament without a knowledge of the Old, because the New Testament assumes that you already have that knowledge base. After all, the entire Bible was written in a Hebrew cultural context, and it was essentially, at least at first, meant to be read by Hebrews. Therefore, the New Testament doesn't explain how the concept of why a king was needed in Israel, or how events led to the advent of King Saul. It doesn't explain what the law is. It doesn't explain what sacrifice or atonement or the priesthood is. It doesn't go into detail over many of God's attributes. It doesn't repeat the commandments of God or the many prophecies that point towards our Messiah. Rather, we're expected to already be familiar with those matters of what generally was common knowledge among the Israelites. Now, most believers are Gentiles who have been graciously invited by the Lord to join ourselves by means of faith in the Jewish Messiah, Jesus the Christ, into a series of covenants that were made between God and the Hebrews. So, with some personal effort and helpful direction, we can certainly comprehend the entire Bible. It won't come by ignoring the first two-thirds of it, or skipping over the hard parts, or thinking that somehow we can approach the Bible as though it was an Anglo-Saxon document created by enlightened Western Europeans. Thus, when a worshiper of Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus Christ, skips over the Hebrew Bible and goes directly to the Brit Hadashah, the New Testament, we get some pretty strange ideas of what's being said in the Gospels, and especially in Paul's often very difficult letters. So let's start off today by completing 2 Samuel chapter 23 and this listing of David's main warriors and officers. I'm not going to reread these verses with these tongue-twisting names in them, many of which are even questionable as a result of a slew of copyist errors over the centuries. But I do want you to open your Bible to 2 Samuel chapter 23, verse 8. And I want you to follow along with me as we move at a goodly pace over this list of people. Now, I mentioned last time that the list was divided into three distinct groups. Each group represented a rank or a position in the chain of command. The first group was the highest rank. The third group was the lowest rank. And of course, we're talking about rank in relative terms. And all of the listed men were commanders and leaders. And only the most important ones were recorded, because there were hundreds more of them. The top general, Joab, was also omitted. Now, either because David didn't much care for him, or because the idea was merely to list everyone below the chief commander. He didn't get much recognition anywhere else. Now, we need to address right up front that the same list also appears in expanded form in 1 Chronicles chapter 11. And the Chronicles list is a little bit different in that there are more names. Interestingly, the somewhat parallel one in 1 Chronicles 11 is followed by yet another list in the following chapter, and it consists of those who joined in with King David, well, actually David before he became a king, and while he was still fleeing from that murderous and paranoid King Saul. Then there is even a third list of men, also in chapter 12 of 1 Chronicles, that are the leaders of those mobilized for the army who came to David at Hebron to transfer Saul's kingship over to him, to David. So it seems as though we might have four different periods of David's life that these lists cover. However, not all scholars agree with that. Now recall that we are exploring a portion of 2 Samuel towards the end of it now that is generally labeled as an appendix. And that's because it's kind of a catch-all of miscellaneous bits of information from during David's reign that some ancient editor thought needed to be added for posterity's sake. The reality is, since the Bible doesn't give us calendar dates, and it pays little attention to the precise time and order of events, there is necessarily substantial speculation by later scholars of just what time period each of these lists of men is referring to. And since at first this historical information was just handed down by word of mouth, generation to generation, and only later on put to pen, it is clear that at times there were slightly differing traditions that developed. And so some details between the traditions as they were remembered differed slightly. So rather than our joining in with all the various speculations about these lists, we're just going to take a brief overview of what is actually written and reasonably verifiable. The chief at the top of the list is a fellow named Yoshev Bashvet Betach Chomoni. He was apparently number one among them all, but of course below Joab. He was also known as Adino de Eitzni, we're told. We know that Yoshev Bashvet is some kind of spelling corruption. So we find an entirely different name for the same person in 1 Chronicles, Yeshovam. Yeshovam. But his claim to fame was he killed 800 men in a single encounter. This does not mean that he single-handedly killed 800 men, or that 800 men is the precise body count. Rather, he was in charge of a battle where about 800 of the enemy were killed, and he too fought valiantly and an example of bravery to his men. Verse 9 begins, after him, and then says, Eleazar, son of Dodo. After him means next in status, next in rank. So Eleazar must have reported to Yeshovam. He is remembered for bravely standing against the Philistines, outmanned, fighting so hard with such stamina and dedication, it says his hand cramped in a death grip around the shank of his sword, much like a bird of prey's claws will involuntarily spring close on its victim, and if they're unable to relax until a certain amount of time goes by, and then their talons naturally release. And after him, in other words, third in the line of command was Shema, son of Agee. He was especially remembered, says, for protecting a field of lentils from the Philistines. In other words, as was customary in that time, it was usual for an invader that one of the first things the Philistines, in this case, went for was their enemy's food supply. Interesting, the place where this happened was Lehi, the same place that Samson also had a famous altercation with the Philistines, reported back in Judges 15. This was where that petulant Hebrew strongman slew many Philistine soldiers with only the jawbone of an ass. Same place. Well, starting in verse 13, we get this famous story whereby three of David's war heroes overheard King David saying how much he desired to have a sip of water from a well that was back in his hometown of Bethlehem. The well was apparently known for its sweet clarity. This occurred at a time, though, when David was hiding in a cave, in a place called the Cave of Adullam, after he had left the territory of the Philistine king of Gath. Many of the disaffected Judahites of the region who hated King Saul heard that David was there, and they came and joined his militia. The Philistines had set up a camp not very far away from the valley of Rephaim, and the three Israelite warriors who heard David's longing for this water fought their way past the Philistines, journeyed to Bethlehem, retrieved the water, fought their way back through the Philistines, and gave the water to David. The rabbis say that David never actually requested the water. At an idle time, he merely was reminiscing about the wonderful tasting water from a certain well of his birth. His soldiers surprised him by the courageous, if not foolhardy, action of bravely fighting this enemy and then bringing this water back to him. But upon receiving this precious gift that was so dearly won for him, David was disappointed. Because he poured it out. Because he poured it out to God as a kind of a drink offering, a libation. Then said that to drink that water would have been as though he was drinking the blood of those three warriors that had been killed. There is no record of an altar at the Cave of Adullam. Almost certainly there was none there. So whatever David was doing, he wasn't making any kind of formal offering to God. David's rationale is quite sound. These men had risked their lives to get for David something as trivial as water that tasted better than the water they already had available. Nicer tasting water is not worth endangering life for. And since life was in the blood, and the men had risked their blood to obtain the water, then it would be as though David was drinking their blood, he says, if he drank that water that had been needlessly obtained at such a high cost. And therefore, he poured it out onto the ground as a sign of refusal to do wrong before Jehovah. Unfortunately, this is not a pious side of David that we're going to see too often as he became king over Israel and Judah. Verse 18 begins the listing now of the second level, the second rank of warrior heroes. And first listed among that group is Abishai. This is David's nephew through his sister Zeruah. Abishai is Joab's brother. Remember, Joab is David's general of the army. Another of this rank is Benaiah. The rabbis say that although we're told at the end of verse 17 that the second rank consisted of only three men, only two are listed. At least that's the surviving document that we have today. Some think the third hero was probably Asahel, who was the brother of Abishai and Joab, who was that guy that was killed by Abner. Now, I suppose that's possible, but we do find Asahel listed as the first name of the third rank of heroes, so I kind of have my doubts about that. I also think it's important to note that there is no implication in this list that the men who are listed were still alive at the time that this list was compiled. In every case, these lists are looking back in time. So in the same way that we can have a valid list of all the presidents of the United States, we can do so without regard to whether they're living or dead, because that's not the point of the list. Abishai held the status as highest of the second group, himself, Yah, and possibly Asahel. His most heroic moment is remembered at the time that he killed 300 men again, like the leader of the first round, Yashubam. It's not claimed that he single-handedly killed 200 men. He fled the battle and was himself especially valiant and courageous in victory. Who that enemy was that they battled against, we're not told. For some reason, Abiyah was given quite a bit of attention. Now, probably it was because he was a trusted favorite to David, and he led David's personal bodyguard. Interestingly, First Chronicles, in its list, explains that Abiyah's father was Jehoiada, who was a priest. So we can reasonably assume that Abiyah was a Levite. So being a warrior and being the king's bodyguard is an unusual occupation for him, until we consider that the priesthood was barely functional in those days, and the Levites were forced to find all kinds of lines of work to survive. The stories that were chosen to best characterize this fellow, Benaiah, are of him killing two men from Moab, a lion in a pit, and a very large Egyptian man. No doubt the first two mentioned exploits were chosen because of the common theme of being involved with a lion, very fearsome animal in those days. That is, despite the many biblical translation renderings from verse 20 about the nature of these two Moabite men, the complete Jewish Bible probably does the best job by explaining them as lion-hearted. The reason is that the Hebrew word used here is Ariel, which means lion of El. Lion is just simply Ariel in Hebrew. But the original Hebrew in this passage adds the word El. El means the highest god of any nation's pantheon of gods. So the words hearted or men don't even exist in this way. Rather, they're added by translators as a means to try to get the sense of it. The Hebrew is actually Ariel Moab, most literally meaning lions of Moab's El. It's assumed from the context, then, that this is speaking of men, warriors, on behalf of Moab's chief god, El, not a pair of lions. However, in the next verse, where Abiyah does kill a lion in a pit, it is indeed the Hebrew word ari, a lion, an animal lion. So these two verses together form a kind of memorable play on words that's very common in ancient oral tradition. In the first case, it's about killing an enemy, a human enemy, on the battlefield. In the second case, you're apparently dealing with a hungry lion that had been driven into a village during a snowy winter, and thus it was willing to take unusual risks to try to find food. Unlucky, this lion falls into somebody's water system. But obviously it can't remain there. So the brave Abiyah is called to the scene, and he kills the dangerous cat. So we have a tradition clue whereby Abiyah shows himself fearless against man and against beast. The ultimate Middle Eastern warrior. Then finally he fights what is essentially a giant. But rather than the more typical Philistine giant, interestingly, this one's an Egyptian. And just as David uses only a shepherd's sling to kill the giant Goliath and then beheaded him with the Philistine's own weapon, so Baniah used only a stick, we're told. A simple stick to disarm this Egyptian giant and then kill him with his own spear. One also remembers David's famous encounter with a lion, as with Baniah. And even that David became known from this incident as the Lion of Judah. No wonder David chose this man to be the chief of his personal royal guard, even over his own family members, which is the more usual thing to do. But one cannot also help but wonder how much of Baniah's legendary exploits were shaped for just this kind of David connection. It would have been perfectly normal for that era to exaggerate a little bit for effect. Now, in this long list of the third rank of men are some familiar names. One name of importance is Eliam, who was Bathsheba's father. Along with him is listed Achitophel, who was Bathsheba's grandfather. The list even includes the ill-fated Uriah the Hittite, who was Bathsheba's husband. This is the guy that David murdered to get Bathsheba. I think when we see the high status of Eliam and Uriah, such that they are assigned hero warrior status, it only adds, in my opinion, to David's depravity and selfishness, that he would show such disrespect by having illicit sex with Eliam's daughter, then having another valuable warrior leader, Uriah, Eliam's son-in-law, assassinated for no other reason than David wanted Uriah's wife for his own. David didn't desire Bathsheba because of some kind of important alliance or political move that in the long run might have been beneficial for him and for Israel. It was because he was entranced with her beauty. He only wanted her in order to satisfy his sexual thirst. That her husband, father, and grandfather were some of David's closest advisors and loyal war commanders apparently meant nothing to him. Let's move on now to the final chapter. 2 Samuel chapter 24. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it is page 364. We're going to read this final chapter together. Second Samuel chapter 24. The anger of Adonai blazed up against Israel, so he moved David to act against them by saying, "Go, take a census of Israel and Judah." The king said to Joab, the commander of the army who was with him, "Go systematically through all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and take a census of the population so that I can know how many people there are." Joab said to the king, "May Adonai your God add to the people 100-fold, no matter how many there are, and may the eyes of my lord the king see it. But why does my lord the king take pleasure in doing this?" However, the king's word prevailed against Joab and the army officers. So Joab and the army officers went out from the king's presence to take a census of the people of Israel. They crossed the Jordan. They pitched camp in Aroer, in the south of the city of the Wadi, to the south of the city in the Wadi of Gad. They went on to Yazer. They came to Gilead. They continued to the land of Tahim Ochi. Then they arrived at Dan Yaan. They went around to Sidon, and they came to the stronghold of Zor. Then they went to the cities of the Hivites and the Canaanites and finished in the south of Judah at Beersheba. And when they were done going through all the land, they came back to Jerusalem. It had taken 9 months and 20 days. Joab reported the results of this census to the king. There were in Israel 800,000 valiant men who could handle a sword, while the men of Judah numbered 500,000. But after he had taken the census, David was conscious. David said to Adonai, "Oh, I have greatly sinned in what I have done. But now, Adonai, please, put aside your servant's sin, for I have done a very foolish thing." And when David got up in the morning, this word of Adonai came to the prophet Gad, who was David's seer. "Go and say to David that this is what Adonai says. I'm giving you a choice. Three punishments. Choose one of them. I will execute it." Gad came to David, and he told him. He said, "Do you want 7 years of famine in your land? Or do you want to flee before your enemies for 3 months while they pursue you? Or do you want 3 days of plague in your land?" Think about it. Tell me what the answer would be. And David said to Gad, "Oh, this is very hard for you. Let us fall into the hand of Adonai, because his mercies are great, rather than having me fall into the hand of a man." So Adonai sent a plague of Israel, a plague upon Israel, from that morning until the end of the specified time. 70,000 people died between Dan and Beersheba. And when the angel stretched out his hand towards Jerusalem to destroy it, Adonai changed his mind about causing such distress and said to the angel who joined the people, The angel of Adonai was at the threshing floor of Arabiah, the Jebusite. David spoke to Adonai when he saw the angel striking the people. He said, "Here, I have sinned. I have done wrong. But these sheep, what have they done here? Please, let your hand be against me and against my father's family." Gad came to David that day and said to him, "Go and set up an altar to Adonai on the threshing floor of Arabnah, the Jebusite." David went up and did what Gad said, as Adonai had ordered. Arabnah looked out and saw the king and his servants coming towards him. Arabnah went out and prostrated himself before the king with his face to the ground. And then Arabnah said, "Why has my lord the king come to us?" And David said, "To buy your threshing floor in order to build an altar to Adonai, so that the plague will be lifted from the people." Arabnah said to David, "Let my lord the king take and offer up anything that seems good. Here are the oxen for the burnt offering. You can use the threshing sledges and the yokes for the oxen as firewood. All this, O king, Arabnah gives to the king." Then Arabnah said to the king, "May Adonai your God." But the king said to Arabnah, "No, I insist on buying it from you at price. So I refuse to offer Adonai, my God, burnt offerings that cost me nothing." So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 1.25 pounds of silver sacrifice. Then David built an altar to Adonai there and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And after this, Adonai took pity on the land and he lifted the plague from Israel. Let me comment immediately. We're going to see a great deal of figurative speech concerning the Lord. That is, we're going to see intense human emotions ascribed to God. And we must be aware that even the greatest, the most ancient Hebrew sages spoke eloquently. That anger and jealousy and sadness and joy and so on, when applied to God, are only figurative. As physical creatures, we humans are quite limited in thought and in vocabulary on just how to characterize the nature of God's divine decisions. We have no other means to communicate about these decisions, these actions of God, other than to prescribe them in common wisdom. What else do you have? Thus, the first word of this chapter is, in English anyway, anger. And interestingly, that's not the literal word of the opening phrase. Rather, it says that Yehovah, God's nostril, his eye, burned. So that figure of speech I warned you about is even more figurative than it kind of appears on the surface. So you've got to see fire breathing, out the nostrils. It is, of course, a figurative Middle Eastern expression that means extreme anger. But it's important to note that this severe divine dissatisfaction is the context of all that's going on. Thus, the census and God's anger are inseparable in this story. We must also notice, as we look back upon what we've learned from the Hebrew Bible to this point, is that invariably, God's anger is provoked by sin, which we could define as the disobedience of his people or the mistreatment of his people by those who aren't his people. The ancient Jewish sages tend to have a ready answer for every obscure thing in the Bible. Even they are flummoxed by this opening verse. And it is because there's no reason given for God's high level of anger. There is no end to the speculation of what it could be. And we're going to consider a couple of possibilities, but this side of heaven, we'll never know the truth. Of the many views on this subject, a couple of them stand out. One is that whatever the nation's sin was, it must have been invisible to David, or he would not have permitted it to happen. Thus, chief among these unspoken, hidden sins that might have caused this problem is that the people didn't beseech David to build a temple. Had they done so, it would have been built during David's day and not Solomon's time. And God's Ark of the Covenant would not have resided unceremoniously in a makeshift tent for decades while the Israelites lived in permanent homes. Another line of thought is more practical. It is that God's wrath was the result of the rebellion of Sheva that had gone unpunished. And such lack of punishment was all the more terrible because the people were severely punished for Absalom's rebellion, and then they turned right around and rebelled against God's anointed again not long afterward. Usually, the parallel account of the last couple of chapters of 2 Samuel that appears in 1 Chronicles fills in some gaping holes for us and answers questions, but not in this case. 1 Chronicles is equally silent on just what the nature was of David's trespass in ordering a census. Now, I don't advocate for any particular solution for the exact reason for God's anger, first against Israel, then against David, that resulted from this census that was taken. However, in the matter of David's census and the punishment that came as a result of it, there is a rather innovative possibility that a modern Christian scholar has come up with that I think is at least worthy of consideration because it explains the matter in the context of violated Torah. Let's talk about that when we get there. First of all, let's straighten out a common misconception about this very first verse of the chapter. It is usually worded such that we have God deciding to take out his wrath on his people by directly instructing David to go take a census of the people, and that's not what's really meant here. What is meant is that God incited David to do something wrong, to do something hurtful, to Israel, and that the thought that David came up with was to order a census. That's what he did. What is so wrong about a census is not itself so straightforward, but next week we're going to take a look at that. The idea is that God did with David what he had at times done with Saul and his Pharaoh. He led them and he incited them to do something that would harm his people. We often like to invoke our Christianese. And in a kind of a sweeping statement, you say, God does not override our free will. Or that God would never incite anyone to do evil. Well, this passage concerning David is just one of several in the Bible that completely refutes that notion. More often than not, when God wants to punish his people, he'll use someone or some nation to do it. In other words, only rarely is the punishment of God's people some kind of cosmic, supernatural event, like when God did in Sodom. The Lord used the emperor of Assyria to punish the northern kingdom of Israel. Then he used King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon to punish the southern kingdom of Judah. Then he used King Cyrus of Persia to punish the people who overpunished his people. And so on and so forth. So we saw in 2 Samuel that often David regarded the defeat and the calamities of war or domestic trouble in his kingdom or in his family, but simply the action of God punishing him using humans as his earthly proxies. And I think that this is a God principle that hasn't changed one iota even since the advent of Yeshua. So as regards verse 1, it is not God saying to David, David, go do a census. Rather, it is David relaying a thought that came to his mind in response to God's excitement, if you would, of David's evil inclination, by his saying to his military commander, go do a census. Now, you can question where I came up with this line of reasoning, but if we go to the parallel account of the same event, in 1 Chronicles 21:1, we find these words. The adversary now rose up against Israel and incited David to take a census of Israel. So in 2 Samuel 24, God incites David. In 1 Chronicles 21, it's the adversary that rises up inside of David. Most Bible versions will not say adversary, but rather Satan. Satan is a Hebrew word that simply means adversary. And only late in history did it ever become the proper name for the devil. Now remember what I told you at the outset of this chapter. We're going to see a lot of figures of speech. And the author of these verses is trying to find the words where there are no words to explain how David's physical action was spiritual. And yet, it was an evil act that took its cue from David's own thought. Pretty mysterious stuff that we believers contend with even today. The answer lies in the principle of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination that resides within all humans, right alongside that good inclination, the Yetzer Tov. Our good inclinations are where godly and righteous thoughts are. Our evil inclinations are where our bad and our wrong thoughts occur. With redemption in Christ, we have the capacity to bring our evil inclinations under Holy Spirit control. But we still often fail. Because under underneath it all, we still like our evil inclinations. We still give in to our evil inclinations. That failure to control our evil inclination causes us to sin. And that is basically what's happening here with David. He's not being influenced by God to do anything that's outside of his normal character. It's just that the Lord is going to use that bad side of David to get there, hurrah, where Satan hangs out, as a vehicle to bring upon just punishment to people of Israel who are sitting before the Lord. So David calls his general of the army, Joab, tells him to count the people. Now, interestingly, David puts it in terms of counting Israel and Judah. Even though Israel is theoretically now a unified kingdom under David, in reality, Israel and Judah are two separate entities that are being ruled over by one king. At least that's how they see themselves. Further, when David says, go, take a census, what it literally says is to go around. In Hebrew, the word that is being translated is shud. And it's a unique word that's not found very often in the Bible, but one place that it is found, and it is rightly offers a good parallel to give just the correct sense of it, interestingly, in the book of Job. In Job 1:7, it says there, Adonai asked the adversary, where are you coming from? And the adversary answered Adonai, I'm coming from roaming throughout the earth, wandering here and there. Where it says roaming around in the complete Jewish Bible, other versions might say I'm going to and fro. Still others will say going on. There's all kinds of attempts to translate the Hebrew word shoot. And here we find that in the same way that the Hebrew word for darkness is koshek is not a benign form of darkness. It's not nighttime. Rather, it's an evil form of darkness. So the Hebrew word shoot, going around, roaming, isn't a benign stroll. You know, like you're going shopping. Rather, it carries with it a very ominous evil undertone. So right away, we know that when David says to shoot, go around, and carry out a census, it's not going to be good. What he is doing. Now, David's military commander is Joab, whose reputation is certainly not that of a cautious or upright man. And he understands that politically speaking, performing a census of the people is a very provocative act on David's part. Nothing good is going to come from it. So he comes to David and suggests him in David's order to perform his census. We're going to continue this and we're going to finish up the book of 2 Samuel.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.